A Vindication of the Rights of Woman by Mary Wollstonecraft. First published in 1792. Second part of Chapter 3. Continuing the discussion of the prevailing opinion about sexual differences. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. It is time to bring about a revolution in female manners, time to restore their lost dignity to them, and to make them, as a part of the human species, work to reform the world by reforming themselves. It is time to separate unchangeable morals from local manners. If men are demigods, then let us indeed serve them. And if the dignity of the female soul is as disputable as that of animals, if women's reason doesn't give enough light to direct their conduct, and if they also lack unerring instinct, they are surely the most miserable of all creatures. Bent beneath the iron hand of destiny, they must submit to being a beautiful defect in creation. In that case, God has made half of mankind at once morally accountable, because they have reason, and yet not accountable, because they don't have enough reason. I challenge moral theologians to point out some conclusive reason for God to behave like that. The only solid foundation for morality appears to be the character of the Supreme Being. The harmony of that character arises from a balance of attributes, and one attribute seems to imply the necessity of another. God must be just, because he is wise. He must be good, because he is omnipotent. To exalt one attribute at the expense of another, equally noble and necessary, one bears the stamp of warped human reason. Man, accustomed to bowing down to power in his savage state, can seldom rid himself of this barbarous prejudice, even when civilization determines how greatly mental strength is superior to bodily strength, and his reason is clouded by these crude opinions, even when he is thinking about God. His omnipotence is made to swallow up or preside over his other attributes, and mortals who think as I do that his power must be regulated by his wisdom are accused of irreverently limiting his power. There is a kind of humility that investigates nature but stops short of nature's author. I disclaim that. The high and lofty one who inhabits eternity no doubt has many attributes of which we can form no conception. But reason tells me that those attributes can't clash with the divine attributes that fill me with loving wonder, and I am compelled to listen to reason's voice. It seems natural for man to search for excellence, and either to find it in the object that he worships, or blindly clothe that object with perfection. But what good effect can the blindly clothing type of worship have on the moral conduct of a rational being? He bends to power. He stands in wonder before a dark cloud, which may open a bright prospect to him, or burst in angry fury on his doomed head without his knowing why. And if God does act on the basis of the vague impulse of an undirected will, what is man to do? He must either follow his own will, or act according to rules derived from principles that he rejects as irreverent. This is a dilemma into which both fanatics and cooler thinkers have fallen, when trying to free men from the wholesome restraints imposed by a correct conception of God's character. It isn't impious to scan God's attributes. We have to do it if we are to exercise our faculties. For someone wanting to acquire either virtue or knowledge, the only useful worship consists in loving God as the fountain of wisdom, goodness, and power. A blind, unsettled affection may, like human passions, occupy the mind and warm the heart, while doing justice, loving mercy, and walking humbly with our God are forgotten. I shall resume this subject when I consider religion in a light opposite to that recommended by Dr. Gregory, who treats it as a matter of sentiment or taste. Returning now from this apparent detour, it is desirable that women's affection for their husbands should be based on the same principle that religious devotion ought to rest on, nowhere in the world is there any other firm base. Let women beware of the misleading light of sentiment, which is often used as a softer phrase for sensuality. So it follows, I think, that from their infancy women should either be shut up, as Asian princes are, or educated in a manner that enables them to think and act for themselves. Why do men halt between two opinions and expect impossibilities? Why do they expect virtue from a slave, or from a being who has been made weak, or worse, by the constitution of civil society? Still, I know that eradicating the firmly rooted prejudices that sensualists have planted will take a long time, and will also take time to convince women that they are acting contrary to their real long-term interests when they value weakness, or pretend to have it, under the name of delicacy, and to convince the world that the poisoned source of female vices and follies has been the sensual homage paid to beauty. I'm talking about beauty of features, for a German writer has shrewdly observed that a pretty woman is an object of desire for men of all descriptions, whereas a fine woman, who inspires more sublime emotions by displaying intellectual beauty, may have no attraction for men who find their happiness in the gratification of their appetites. I can see an obvious retort that may be made, namely, for as long as man goes on being as imperfect as he appears to have been so far, he will be pretty much the slave of his appetites. And it is always the case that the women who get the most power are those who gratify a predominant appetite. So the female sex will be degraded. This isn't morally right, but it is inevitable. This objection has some force, I admit. But in the light of the sublime precept, "Be pure as your heavenly Father is pure," it would seem that God hasn't set any limits to the virtues of man, and that man may press forward without considering whether he is stepping out of his sphere by harbouring such a noble ambition as to be as pure as God is. Matter yields to the great governing spirit by following the causal laws that God has established. But an immortal human soul, not restrained by mechanical laws, and struggling to free itself from matter's shackles, doesn't disturb the order of creation. Indeed, it contributes to it, when it tries with God's help to govern itself by the invariable laws by which God regulates the universe. Besides, if women are educated for dependence, i.e., to act according to the will of another fallible being, and to submit to power whether it is right or wrong, where are we to stop? Are they to be considered as vice-regents, allowed to reign over a small domain, and answerable for their conduct to a higher tribunal that is as liable to error as they are? It won't be difficult to prove that such deputies will act like men who are held down by fear, and will make their children and servants endure their tyrannical oppression. As they submit without reason, so also they will govern without reason. Having no fixed rules against which to judge their conduct, they will be kind or cruel as the mood takes them, and it won't be surprising if sometimes, chafing under their heavy yoke, they take a malignant pleasure in resting it on weaker shoulders. Consider this case. A woman who has been trained up to obedience marries a sensible man, who directs her judgment without making her feel the servility of her subjection. He helps her to act, by this reflected light, with as much propriety as can be expected when reason is taken at second hand, but she can't ensure the life of her protector. He dies, and leaves her with a large family. She now has a double duty, to play both the mother's and the father's part in educating her children, forming their principles, and securing their property. But she has never thought for herself, much less acted for herself. She has only learned to please men, to depend gracefully on them. But how, with her burden of children, is she to obtain another protector, another husband to supply the place of reason? A rational man—we aren't treading on romantic ground, though he may think her a pleasing, docile creature—won't choose to marry a family for love, when the world contains many creatures who are prettier than she is. What, then, is to become of her? She either falls an easy prey to some mean fortune-hunter, who defrauds her children of their paternal inheritance, and makes her miserable, or becomes the victim of discontent and blind indulgence. Unable to educate her sons or get them to respect her, she suffers under the anguish of impotent regret. The serpent's tooth enters into her very soul, and the vices of lawless youth bring her with sorrow, and perhaps also with poverty, to the grave. It seems likely that someone who has been taught only to please must still find her happiness in pleasing, and if that is true of this woman, what an example of folly, and even vice, she will be to her innocent daughters. The mother will be lost in the coquette, and instead of making friends of her daughters, she will view them with suspicion, because they are her rivals, the cruelest rivals, because they invite a comparison, and drive her from the throne of beauty, she who has never thought of a seat on the bench of reason. It doesn't require a lively pencil to sketch the domestic miseries and petty vices which such a mistress of a family spreads around her. Yet she is only acting as a woman ought to act, if she has been brought up according to Rousseau's system. She can't be reproached for being masculine, or stepping out of her sphere. Indeed, she may conform to his rules well enough to be reckoned a good kind of woman. Yet in what respect can she be termed good? It's true that she abstains, without any great struggle, from committing gross crimes. But how does she fulfil her duties? Duties? She has no time or energy for duties, when she has enough to think about in adorning her body and nursing a weak constitution. With regard to religion, she never presumed to judge for herself. As a dependent creature should, she conformed to the ceremonies of the church she was brought up in, piously believing that wiser heads than her own have settled that business, and her idea of perfection in religious matters is not to doubt. So she makes her little weekly payment to the church, and thanks her God that she is not as other women are. These are the blessed effects of a good education. These are the virtues of man's helpmate. I must relieve myself by drawing a different picture. Now, let us imagine a woman with a fairly good understanding, I don't want to deal with extremes, whose constitution, strengthened by physical exercise, has allowed her body to acquire its full vigour, while her mind has gradually expanded itself to understand the moral duties of life and what human virtue and dignity consist in. Formed in this way by the duties she has because of her position in life, she marries from affection, without losing sight of prudence, and she secures her husband's respect before there's any need to exert underhanded tricks to please him and feed a dying flame of love. Nature dooms that to expire when the loved one becomes familiar, when friendship and forbearance take the place of a more ardent affection. This is the natural death of love, and in the marriage I am describing here, domestic peace is not destroyed by struggles to prevent the death from happening. I am also supposing the husband to be virtuous. Fate, however, breaks this tie. She is left a widow, without enough to live on comfortably, but she is not desolate. The pang of nature is felt, but after time has softened sorrow into sad resignation. Her heart turns to her children with redoubled fondness, and in her anxiety to provide for them, her affection presents her maternal duties as sacred and heroic. She thinks that her virtuous efforts are seen by the eye of God, from whom all her comfort now must flow, and whose approval is life. And her imagination, a little abstracted and exalted by grief, lets her hope that her husband's eyes still see how she subdues every wayward passion in order to fulfil the double duty of being father as well as mother to her children. Raised to heroism by misfortunes, she represses the first faint dawnings of her natural inclination before it ripens into love. And in the bloom of life she forgets her sex, forgets the pleasure of an awakening passion, which might again have been inspired and returned. Her children have her love, and her brightest hopes are beyond the grave, where her imagination often strays. I think I see her, surrounded by her children, reaping the reward of her care, their chubby cheeks glow with health and innocence, and as they grow up, the cares of her life are lessened by their grateful attention. She lives to see the virtues that she tried to implant in her children through principles become fixed in them as habits, and to see her children achieve enough strength of character to be able to endure adversity without forgetting their mother's example. The task of life, thus fulfilled, she calmly waits for the sleep of death. When she rises from the grave, she can say to God, "Behold, you gave me a talent, and here are 5 talents. I want to sum up what I have said in a few words. I here throw down my gauntlet, and deny that there is any way for a woman to be virtuous that isn't also a way for a man to be virtuous, and modesty is not an exception to that. If I understand the meaning of the word, truth must be the same for man and for woman. Yet the fanciful female character, so prettily drawn by poets and novelists, demands the sacrifice of truth and sincerity, and so virtue becomes a relative idea, based on nothing but utility, and men set themselves up as judges of utility, shaping it to their own convenience. Women may have different duties to fulfil, but they are human duties, and I firmly maintain that the principles that should regulate the performance of them must be the ones that hold for all human beings. To become worthy of respect, women must use their understandings. There is no other basis for independence of character. I mean explicitly to say that they must only bow to the authority of reason instead of being the modest slaves of opinion. In the upper ranks of life, we seldom meet with a man of superior abilities, or even one whose abilities are about average. The reason seems to me clear. The state they are born in was an unnatural one. The human character has always been formed by the employments the individual or class pursues, and if the faculties are not sharpened by necessity, they must remain blunt. The same line of thought can fairly be extended to women. Women in general tend to be dim, in the way that men who have titles or high rank or great wealth tend to be dim. That is because most of them have no serious occupations. They are left to the pursuit of pleasure, which gives to their character the triviality that makes the society of the great so insipid. The lack of firmness, produced by a similar cause, forces both great men and all women to fly from themselves to noisy pleasures and artificial passions, until vanity takes the place of every social affection, and the characteristics of humanity almost disappear from sight. Such are the blessings of civil governments, as they are at present organized, that wealth and female softness equally tend to debase mankind, and are produced by the same cause. If women are rational creatures, they should be urged to acquire virtues that they can call their own. For how can a rational being be ennobled by anything that is not obtained by his or her own efforts? End of chapter 3.